Out of the street corners, they scream. You knew it was coming. You've been waiting for this for months. Rumor hardened into fear, and now they scream at you. The sirens, their hysterical wail tearing through the white noise of the city. And you run. You run to pick up those things that can never be replaced. A picture of them in the days when they still loved you. Your mother's wedding ring. And then you turn to your shelf of games. You only have room for five. Five games for Doomsday. Five Games for Doomsday is a show in which board game personalities are thrust into a cabin in the woods to outrun an oncoming disaster, but can only take five of their games with them. But which will they choose? My guest this week is an expert in the business of board games, one of the founders of Board Game Co. He's successfully been facilitating the sales of board games for years. Not only that, he has a rapidly growing YouTube channel in which he covers the hobby in totality. My guest this week is Alex Radcliffe. Alex, welcome to the cabin.
How's it going? Thank you for having me. It's nice and cozy in here.
It is. I like the sort of objet d'art made out of amputated zombie parts.
Well, I was referring more to the temperature. It's a little hot, like back home, but the decor is not that bad either.
So my first question is then, is how difficult was it for you to choose the five games to take to the cabin?
So choosing the five games wasn't that difficult because I think as a starting baseline, we walk into this with a degree of, great, I've done top 10 lists, I've done top whatevers, and so which games from those call it to me the most? Where the five games concept differs and makes it a far more interesting puzzle is the top 10 is the top 10, but you still have the 90 behind that and the 100 behind that and whatever numbers. The five games for Doomsday is just those five. And so from there, I'm just trying to hit different genres and different categories of things to try to ensure that in some way, shape, or form, I'm getting as many as possible of both what I love while also having a degree of hitting all my bases.
And so is there any nostalgia wrapped up in that? Because I think if I was in your position, I would take certain games that I don't necessarily play, but that would unlock sort of melancholy memories of victories past.
Not as much nostalgia attached to it. I one thing we haven't even gotten to yet, but we can easily dive into it, is I am one of the least, what's the word for it? Not nostalgic, but there's another word when you attach sentimental. I am one of the least sentimental people I know. I love people. I love experiences. I have a good time with like that kind of concept, but I don't really attach memories to objects past the memories themselves. Although, random and unrelated fun fact, I do have a little thing that happens with, I mean, I'm sure it happens with other people, but I know it happens with me, where when I hear a song that I haven't heard in a long time, I almost always get immediately taken back to where and when I first heard that song in a way that hits me like almost like a gut punch sometimes, which I do love that. But in objects, not as much.
I mean, are you a sentimental person in general? I mean, you know, you have kids. I mean, do you keep their booties from when they were 6 months old and, you know, sort of things like that and get all misty-eyed when you look at them? Not in the slightest.
I don't keep their home. Well, let me rephrase. We do keep some things, but that's because my wife does fall more into the sentimental category. For myself, school projects from my own growing up or theirs as they're growing up, those things don't really do it for me. I do love photographs, and so I appreciate memories in that sense, looking back at a photo or a video. Those I really do resonate with strongly. But anything that they made or I don't even know past that, those kinds of things or objects, you know, if my father left me a watch, I would just view it as, is it a good watch or not a good watch? I wouldn't really view it so much as, you know, it's his watch. So memories, 100%, but attaching that aspect to objects never really did it for me.
I mean, you're a person who is kind of expert in acquiring games and flipping them. I mean, do you think that's part of it? That, you know, you're so able to be so efficient with that because you don't hold sentimental attachment to objects?
I've never put those two together mentally, but there likely is a degree of something to that. I speak to a lot of people about the nature of getting rid of games, and very often they struggle with either the memories aspect or even just the holding on to it. But it's something I've played. What if I want to play it again? I tend to be very cutthroat with that separation. And that's something it's an emotional aspect that carries far past board games and into the emotional realm as well. Of like, I tend to... I'm someone that when something bad is happening, whether it's my basement's flooding, whether it's I'm getting a ticket, I do work very hard. And I've been working very hard for a very long time to try to mentally separate the bad thing versus the mental attachment to the bad thing. The additional rabbit hole of, oh no, I got a ticket. Well, you can get a ticket and you can let it ruin your day, or you could just get a ticket. And I've worked very hard in many aspects of since I was 14, 15, I remember having like these core memories of trying to separate out negative emotions from negative instances and trying to target when and where they're helpful. And that has had a degree of coldness in terms of the way I can approach certain things. It doesn't necessarily separate good emotions, because I welcome good emotions. That's another thing, I guess, now that we're going down this rabbit hole, I love chick flicks and I love crying doing chick flicks. Like, they're very much, you know, you give me a sob story in some way, shape or form, someone dying of the wrong illness, some love that can't be found. You give me those stories and I will tear up like no tomorrow. But I tend to welcome certain emotions as very positive and then not be quite as attached to others if I feel that they're holding me back in some way.
I mean, so imagine, you know, I want you to step out of yourself now and imagine that you see yourself meet someone new for the first time. Do you think they would see you as a very sort of calm, cold, rational person, or do you think you come across as a warm person?
That's an interesting one. I think it depends. I think it depends on whether I'm paying attention or not. And it depends on the context and the people and the situations. So a good example offhand would be conventions. You know, if you go to a board game convention, especially nowadays, the way I'm going to a board game convention, knowing fully well that I have a channel, I have people who see me and stuff like that. And so I tend to walk into something like that with great intent, with a mindfulness that someone who might not know me, someone who I might not know, they might know me. And so I almost am very intentionally over the top warm in those types of situations, where if somebody in any way even catches my eye in a way that makes me think they might know who I am, I want to be welcoming, because there's always that weird wall where someone might know me, but I don't know them. And so I walk in with good intent and I imagine that I probably do come across as warm because I'm very specifically trying to. But the flip side is, throw me into a circumstance in a setting in which I'm not necessarily quite as on, and I probably don't come across quite as emotionally warm at first. It depends on the circumstance of the situation. If it's something that I'm looking at as a potential friendship, then I do very much try to act towards the person in a way that is friendly. But offhand, off the cuff, I don't know. It's not something I've given it an intense amount of thought, but I don't walk around as a warm, cuddly ball of emotion, but I also do try to be friendly and positive towards people I interact with. So could go either way on that one.
So let's go back to the beginning then. So you grew up in Toronto, one of six children. How was it growing up with that many siblings?
It was rowdy. We have one older sister, and then it was me and four other boys. So the five of us just running around in the backyard on milk crates scattered through the yard, pretending the ground is lava or whatnot, using the unscrewed edge of a broom to be able to have, like, you know, multiple staff fights back and forth, pushing each other into the backyard. We were rowdy. We had fun with each other. We wrestled, we played, we fought. We fought over who could have the computer time when we had the newest video game that we got, or who got the latest Harry Potter when we were getting those way back. And so I think it was a rowdy but exciting and enjoyable childhood. Like, I still have relationships with all my siblings, fortunately. Like, I'm just talking to a friend yesterday who's one of three, and they don't talk to one of their siblings. And fortunately, we all are fairly close, different degrees, but all fairly close, all still talk to each other, all still see each other. But it was a rowdy childhood with mostly fond memories, a lot of heartache and pain at different points in a life, but one that I look back fondly on.
I mean, you grew up as an Orthodox Jew. Did you stand out amongst your peers at school and people in your neighborhood, or were you in a Jewish area of Toronto?
So very much in a Jewish area. The Orthodox Judaism tends to kind of migrate to a degree. Part of it is just the desire for community, and part of it is even just practical, because we don't do a lot of things on Saturday, on Shabbat. That includes driving, and that means if you want to have a relationship with your friends, you kind of have to live in clustered areas. And so you'll often find clustered areas that are Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods, and we are very much in one of them. Now, that does not mean everyone there is Jewish. It just means that there's a higher percentage of Jews, and let's say my my block growing up, for example, is probably half Orthodox Jews and half not. And it does mean that to some extent you stand out, but you're also standing out with a lot of others that are standing out at the same time. Also, at the same time, went to an Orthodox Jewish private school growing up. Same idea. There's no standing out there. We're all doing the same thing. I would say that the point in time which I first really noticed that standout aspect was likely when I went to university in Toronto. Because up until then, I went to a Jewish high school, I went to a Jewish middle school, I was in a Jewish neighborhood, went to a Jewish events, certainly encountered many non-Jews along the way and engaged with them, but I was never felt like the odd one out. Once I went to university, that was probably the first time in which there was a real degree of, okay, great, I'm going to school now with a lot of people, and I'm definitely part of a much smaller minority, and I have to engage in different ways and react to lifestyles and adjustments that are not built around my lifestyle, even the nature of just holidays. You know, going to a Jewish school and being in a Jewish neighborhood, holidays were just part of the schedule. Going to university, holidays had to be danced around, the nature of a Jewish holiday conflicting with a test and trying to have to figure out how and when to make university work when you have a string of three or four holidays in a row and you have to miss three or four classes. There's a degree of sudden adjustment to real life as the sheltered, I guess, lifestyle I grew up with suddenly faded away into the background.
I mean, I'm devastatingly average. I was average in the place that I grew up in, and I'm average in the place that I live now. And so I've never really, you know, experienced the feeling of being conspicuously different, I guess. I mean, have you ever experienced anti-Semitism in your life? I mean, you wear a yarmulke, and so you're sort of publicly Jewish. Have you experienced anti-Semitism in your daily life?
So the way I tend to put that is I very possibly have, but if I have, it's never been in a way. I guess there's two kinds. There's two kinds of anti-Semitism, the way I'd put it. The first is the obvious kind. Someone driving down the street yelling out, "Hey, Jew," or something, you know, or go whatever. Like, I don't even want to do the various explicitives or whatever that they might say, but I've had that happen. I've had someone drive by saying, "Go kill yourself, you Jew." Like, I've had that. But that one's almost interesting because the nature of the people doing this is they're very often teenagers. I would say almost exclusively the types of direct interactions I've ever had, and I could probably count them on one hand. It's not like a significant amount, but those kinds of interactions are almost always from younger people, from teenagers. And so even though the behavior is anti-Semitic, I tend to assume that the actual intent is just immaturity. The very nature of being a teenager where you think it's funny to scroll a swastika on a wall, when it's an adult doing it, it's anti-Semitism. When it's a teenager doing it, it could go either way, but I tend to assume there's far more immaturity than there is anti-Semitism. So maybe, but also I don't really know. The second kind is even harder to analyze, which is where it's not obvious, where it's not in your face, but where there's a degree of some form of something. The job you didn't get, the callback that never happened, the interaction that was a little bit more subtle and shaded than could have otherwise been, and you don't know if the person was having a bad day or if they just don't like you. And those are hard to read into, but I tend to fall into the same general camp, which is I tend to assume there's a far more innocent reasons for those kinds of interactions than there are nefarious ones. So I would say it's statistically likely that I have experienced anti-Semitism, but I don't typically view it as such. I view the obvious interactions as immature and the subtle interactions as how am I to know which ones are which, and I'd rather not walk through my entire life worrying that something was anti-Semitism. I'd rather just not worry about it at all.
So you went to high school in the United States. I mean, apart from, you know, being, you know, part of a particular religion. I mean, is there a feeling of culture shock for a Canadian being in America, or are the cultures so almost indistinguishable?
I would say mostly almost indistinguishable with subtle shades of differences. The subtle shades can come through from anything as innocent as wordplay. It took me a long time to re-mentally connect a bathroom as being the thing as opposed to a washroom. Growing up, it was always a washroom. Now I say bathroom as part of my vocabulary, but it took me like a year of, you know, having people point out that I was saying the wrong word until I got that into my system. I would say the only real noticeable difference is there is a degree, and this is something that Canadians get made fun of all the time, but Canadians are more polite, or at least the experiences I've had growing up were definitely different in the level of politeness I had growing up in Canada versus in the U.S. The U.S. is a drop more, and to be very clear, I grew up in Toronto, I went to high school in Cleveland, so the extrapolation is mostly going to reflect those two, but there's definitely a higher degree of just general politeness, not even niceness. I wouldn't be afraid to phrase it as niceness. I think Cleveland in general has always been a very nice place to be. It was always very engaging. But just the general politeness of walking past each other, of the apologies when you didn't even do anything wrong, but someone else, whatever, just walking past, you both bump shoulders, you both apologize, they bumped you, you bumped them, no one really cares. The degree of just basic good mornings and politeness, I think that was noticeably more prevalent in Canada growing up. And it took me a bit to adjust to the fact that the U.S. was just a drop more reserved in how easily those platitudes got thrown back and forth. But past that, very, very minimal, I'd say.
So how did hobby games enter your life, and what were the ones that really grabbed you and pulled you in?
So like many, I had a bunch of classics growing up that I engaged in different ways. I started with Risk. I grew up with many of the basics, Risk, Monopoly, all of that stuff. Catan definitely entered my life at some point early enough that it was like, ooh, that fun thing everyone's playing. I engaged with the game of Axis and Allies once upon a time, things like that, a Carcassonne, Corridor. There were like these offshoots that entered my life at different points. For me, the one that really started to push me down the rabbit hole was after being married. I moved to Cleveland. I was in the U.S. at that point, and I had my brother-in-law. He came back from out of town, and he brought with him from, he was in university or college or whatever, he brought back with him a copy of Small World. And we played Small World, and we really enjoyed Small World, and I was like, well, that was a fun experience. And then 3 months later, he comes back with a copy of Stone Age, and we really enjoyed that. And I was a little confused because these were two games that kind of felt like they were in the vein of Catan, of being a really enjoyable experience outside the realm of what I had ever heard of growing up. And they were within 2 or 3 month period apart from one another. And I started Googling and looking into things and looking into more things. And before you know it, I had really dived very deep into this hobby, had a few purchases of all the expansions for Small World, grabbed a copy of Stone Age, grabbed a copy of a bunch of other games that I looked into, and started to enter the hobby with a lot of buying games and never really looking back.
And so you live in Cleveland, as you've mentioned. I mean, what is the board game scene like there?
The board game scene in Cleveland is decent, and decent is the key word, because I don't really know if I have enough comparison to go off of as far as what different cities are like. But they have meetup.com, they do have occasional meetups here and there. There are definitely people around that you can meet up to engage with different types of game groups. I've encountered easily dozens of people, incidentally, in Cleveland, who are part of the board game scene and engage with in different ways and are parts of different game groups. But like, I assume like most places, I don't actually know, you have to be willing to put out the effort. You have to be willing to, you know, to go to these meetups or to reach out on Facebook in a game group and say, hey, who's in Cleveland, who's whatever. So there are definitely people here, and there are active game groups and opportunities for those who want to seek them. But it's also the kind of place where you can easily go your entire life and not engage with another gamer if you're not trying to be out there, so to speak. So decent, but I don't necessarily have a large point of comparison to other areas.
So your first game then is a big one, and this is Terraforming Mars. So this game has been a huge success. Why do you think that is?
Oh, if I knew the answer there, we'd have a different conversation. I don't know what it is about Terraforming Mars. I still, to this day, can't really put my finger on it as far as why it's so compelling at what it does. I will say tableau building inherently already has a degree of appeal to it. It has a degree of you're building something up, no differently than the strong appeal of, you know, when you play The Sims on the computer game, whatnot, and you sit there and you have your little Sims go out and lift weights or get jobs, all the things that might be tedious in real life, but they're somehow rewarding in a game. I think tableau building as a concept always has an appeal, and I think Terraforming Mars very strongly leans into that appeal, but not just with, hey, here's a way to build a tableau, but here's like hundreds of cards of different directions and opportunities and pathways of how to build a tableau, such that you have the reward of tableau building and yet the huge degree of variability of it all being present on cards in an engine that works together in a way that ties nicely together with each other. And then, of course, they threw in drafting, which drafting just makes the entire experience even more compelling, albeit a little longer as well. But I'm sure you can find other games that also hit those nuances and recipes and don't do as well. So I think tableau building with a high degree of variability and a high degree of strategic depth does work decently. I don't know if it's a guaranteed success as far as why other games would or wouldn't do it, but it definitely worked well for Terraforming Mars.
So I've played it a couple of times, and, you know, I in my area when it first came out, it was one of those things that people did get really hype about. And I played it and I thought, yeah, this is fine. And it didn't blow me away, but
I was frankly appalled by the Take That cards in the game. Defend the Take That cards to me.
So Terraforming Mars is a game that has enough Take That that it makes it a continuous experience the entire time, as well as not so much Take That that it makes it problematic. What I mean by that is any multiplayer game without any form of Take That or control inherently has the potential of leaning into the concept of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The idea that if I get a good engine up and running early on, well, then I'll continue to monopolize that engine. And in a game of Terraforming Mars, which could be 3.5-4 hours long, depending on what you're doing, what expansions you have, how slow the players are, that just means that potentially an hour and a half into the game, there's someone who's clearly doing better, and there's no opportunities for others to really do anything about it other than just continue playing and try to focus on having a good time, which is fun. But I think games in which you have a chance of winning are always better regardless of actually winning. It's that pursuit that's more important than the actual end result. And so I find games that don't have some degree of catch-up around that, whatever that catch-up mechanism could look like, it could have a problem if they're longer experiences. I think Terraforming Mars has enough Take That in the cards that there is that opportunity of targeting that leader. There is the opportunity of saying, hey, look, Richard over there is currently doing far better than we are, and if we don't go ahead and blast his plants out of the way, then he's just going to take the game. The flip side is I find that the Take That is not so prevalent that it doesn't make the game a completely obnoxious game for Richard as he's doing well. There's just enough cards that remove plants, just enough cards that remove a little bit of production that you can efficiently target the leader and have some sort of dent in their otherwise well-flowing engine. But it's not so much that Richard has to worry about constantly playing cards. He knows he'll get attacked here and there. He knows he'll get targeted. It's the price of success, the price of doing well. But it manages to include just enough that is annoying, but balancing, and not so much that it ruins the game.
And is this still the best version of the game?
For me, it definitely is. Ideally with the Prelude expansion, that's the only way I really like to play it. But for me, I would say that if you're comparing to like anything else out there, Terraforming Mars, the dozens of expansions, the Ares Expedition, I still find Terraforming Mars gives me the most robust experience. I find Ares Expedition as a competitor gives me a very decent experience, but one, a very solid one. I very much enjoy it, but one that is not as enjoyable as the base game, not even remotely close to it. And then there's other games as well that try to hit the same genre, which are not even Terraforming Mars, but different games that different people have had them work well in different ways. There's Mosaic, which I often compare to Terraforming Mars. There's Ark Nova, which is climbing through the ranks. And different people will get hit in different games in different ways. Ark Nova, for sure, is definitely seeing a massive degree of success that is beyond compelling. But for me, Terraforming Mars has yet to be outclassed within the genre that it is.
So I want to talk now about Board Game Co. So firstly, are you the kind of person that always tries to monetize things you're into?
I would answer that question a drop differently. I would say, first of all, mostly yes. But I would say that I very often don't like operating in a degree of pure whim. I like to operate with intent. So very often I'm either trying to monetize the things I'm into to further justify the time, or I'm operating with a degree of, and this is where the line is, and no, I don't want to monetize that, with almost an exact opposite intent because I want to keep that thing alive. At the same time, or I shouldn't say alive, I'm very into board games, but whatever it is, whatever separation I want to have. But when it comes to board games or the concept in general, I've definitely monetized multiple things in my life. I started off very young as the lemonade stand kid, as far as, you know, being the type of kid, never actually ran a lemonade stand, but I did lots of things like that, ran canteens, brought various snacks to school and sold them and all that stuff. I very much had the mentality of trying to figure out where to make money. And that also became something that when I engaged in different hobbies, sometimes it would manifest. Not always, but sometimes. So with Warhammer, when I played Warhammer, never did anything about that. Video games, never tried to do anything about that. But when I tried playing Magic the Gathering, I can't remember exactly when I got into it, but somewhere around 17-ish or something, I don't know exactly. But I got into Magic the Gathering, and I absolutely turned Magic the Gathering into an online store while I was heavily involved in the hobby. With board games, I absolutely turned it into this while I was involved in that. So I would say that I would say more that I am the kind of person who sees opportunities for making money, and sometimes those happen to coincide with the thing that I'm into as a hobby.
And so developing that then, I mean, how did you get the idea for Board Game Co?
Not with intent. Not with any intent. It was me trying to, I guess the way I put it is, I mentioned, you know, I learned two games or found out about two games, and then suddenly before you know it, I'm several shopping carts in on trying to buy board games. And that wasn't just a one-time thing. That was an ongoing thing, as I spent hundreds of dollars every single month while I was getting heavily into the hobby. And before you know it, I had too many games, was not playing them as quickly as I was getting them, and I realized I had to in some way slow down. And so I started getting involved in trading instead. I went on Board Game Geek and started trading the games that weren't working for me for the games that were. And that turned into a thing where I found this opportunity to trade games away and get new stuff and not have to worry with money. And at a certain point, I kind of woke up one day and realized that the people who seemed to get a lot of trade requests were the people who had all their games up for trade. The people who had 50 games available for trade, not just four, not just five, 50 available for trade, and people would hunt them down and send requests their way. And I kind of decided to try an experiment, a very nerve-wracking experiment, where instead of only trading away the games I had played and didn't like anymore, I actually opened the floodgates on all the games that I had in my collection that I had not played. So not the ones I played. If I played you and I loved you, no problem, I kept you. But there were like a good few hundred games that I had that I had acquired that I had not played yet, and I just put them all up for trade, and then I marked my want list accordingly of the things I wanted. And once I had people coming to me, I kind of felt like I had more opportunity to say, this is the trade that I'm willing to sign up for. So sure, you send me these five games, I'll send you these three, and it works out. Or, you know, you get a good trade out of it. You don't have to go to multiple people, but I get the better end of the deal, so to speak, because you came to me because I have all this stuff available. And the entire intent of this principle was an experiment to see if I could try to basically get trades that favored myself, just for the sake of trying to get a continuously growing collection without actually having to spend as much money as I was every single month. And it worked. Not only did it worked with a speed and a degree of just complete success that I did not see coming, that within a matter of months, I realized I didn't have a cute, clever way of getting games on the cheap. I had an actual business here because people were desperately looking for a large-scale trading partner in a way that no one else was really offering, and they found with me. And so from there, it just became a matter of time as my basement slowly grew, as I realized it was a business, as I started selling games to pay for all the shipping costs and handling costs and all these things involved, and then eventually moving it to a warehouse and starting a real process of having employees and accountants and taxes and all the real stuff that make the business significantly less sexy and significantly less profitable, but an actual business at the same time.
And so how long did it take to get to that point with the warehouse, with the accountants, with the employees? And did it rub the shine off to some degree?
It took roughly a year and a half. I don't have exact dates back then, but I know when we went to the warehouse, but I don't have the dates of when other things started. And I want to say it was roughly a year and a half. It was about a half a year of me being in the hobby on my own, about a year and a half of it starting to turn into this process, and then realizing the side hustle was turning into a real side hustle, was turning into an actual business, and then had to go to a warehouse. Roughly a year and a half, and then in late 2014 is when it went all to that warehouse. It definitely took the shine and hustle off, although not necessarily for the reasons you might think. In a way, it was actually nicer to turn into a real business, partially because there's a degree of understanding out there for business versus a individual running a side hustle. When I'm Alex, you know, just running a side hustle of trading games for other games and trying to get the better deal, there's a degree of frustration around that. There's a degree of who are you and why are you trying to take advantage of the system to get a better deal. But when you suddenly introduce costs and employees and taxes, and it's no longer about me trying to get a bit about a deal, but rather about a business offering a service, there was a degree of increased understanding and acceptance from the people in the board game space that actually made it less stressful and easier. The flip side and the trade-off of that is suddenly I stopped making money. I went from a business that was actually making money to having other people that are making money and me making absolutely nothing on this as I tried to just desperately keep up with costs. And that continued for roughly 4 years of not making money, to the point that in 2018, we were actually considering closing down the business because we're like, hey, it's been 4 years of growth. There was growth the entire time. There was constant increase in our volume, increase in our customer base, increase in everything. I did get free games, to be very clear. I didn't walk away with nothing. But for 4 years, I didn't write myself a single check. I worked for 3 to 4 hours a day, every single day without a check, watching the business grow, but not watching anything actually happen as far as taking out a paycheck. And that definitely takes the shine off of things.
And so did it ever encroach into your enjoyment of gaming at all?
I was worried at many points that it would. The general concept that if you turn your hobby into a business, you might find that you lose your hobby is definitely a concept that exists. it never did with me. I would argue, and this is something that's a longer conversation, I would argue YouTube has actually had more of an interesting effect on my hobby, both for better and for worse, but it has had that worse aspect, versus board games, where running a board game store managed to be fairly separate. It was a retail operation that happened to dabble in the thing that I loved, but it never really had an effect on the thing that I loved. I guess the way I'd put it is, if you draw for fun, for example, if you draw for enjoyment and you suddenly find yourself selling your drawings, well, the thing that you're doing for fun is the thing that you're selling. Versus in the case of board games, I wasn't. I was selling an object, and I happened to enjoy that object, but I wasn't engaged in any form of the things I did within board games that were fun were never the things that I did within the business that were fun. They were completely separate things that happened to involve the things that were fun.
So your next game then is Inish. Where does this rank in the three Matago area control games?
Easily the best one. Easily. Not even close. I mean, I say not even close with all three of them being absolutely amazing games that I adore in different ways. But to me, Inish is, I would say Cyclades and Kemet, I've gone back and forth on at times. Inish to me is the winner. It's been the winner since the first time I ever tried comparing them to one another, and it's still the winner today. It is easily the one that plays in the potentially shortest playtime. I say potentially because we have had games that dragged out. It is a game that feels the most elegant and lets you feel the most clever as you try to figure out how to actually find that win. And it's just so compelling. It's something that, as there's a saying we have in our game group, where whenever we play Inish, we manage to somehow at some point say, but it's never happened that way before, as we find new opportunities, new things that experience. Even just this past week, I played a game of Inish that we once again said, it's never happened that way before, as the map barely grew the entire time. As a card that, there's one card that lets the map grow, and it just kept being buried and not used, and the map didn't grow at all the entire game, and we were just like, we had an entire game with a new circumstance, a new construct. I find that Inish just is elegant and magical in what it does. Absolutely amazing game.
And to what degree does the setting and the art contribute to the game being engrossing?
I don't know the answer to that entirely. I can tell you that I actually avoided Inish initially because of the art. That art style, which, while very beautiful, is not the style that I typically find myself attracted to initially. And I saw the art of Inish, and I was like, oh, it's very nice, you know, almost folklore style art. Very nice, but also not my genre. And I kind of ignored it at first. I think when it comes to Inish, I fell in love with the mechanics first and only then started to really appreciate the art and how unique and beautiful it is. But it actually pushed me away at first.
And so I have people in my game group who complain that this game never ends. And can you tell me why they're wrong?
So the concept that never ends, I guess the way I'd put it is, I did allude to the idea that we have had games of Inish that can just go on and go on and go on as people try to seek a victory condition that never happens. And so Inish, which is a game that I typically consider a 90-minute long experience, we've had four-hour-long games of it, which is typically can be frustrating when you've mentally booked a 90-minute long experience. But I do think that for us, that is the exception. Inish is a game of trying to vie for one of three victory conditions, and the players getting in each other's ways the entire time can make that process as elusive as it is close the entire time, as one player achieves a condition and someone else pushes it out. But I think as the game progresses, as the map expands, as more sanctuaries enter the board, there's more and more opportunities for winning. And then if you're playing it, I hesitate to use the word right, but I'll use the word right. If you're playing it right, then you're going to have players who are holding on to epic tail cards the entire time, holding on to epic tail cards to ensure that when they eventually go for that win, they're going for the win with five or six tricks up their sleeve to push past the fact that at any given point, as soon as you try going for a win, someone else is trying to get in your way. Someone else is trying to shut you down. Someone else is trying to make the game to continue for one more round so that they can win, which is why having those tricks up your sleeve is important. And it's going to come down to the timing of when you push it and whether you have just enough things that you can throw at people to ensure you break through. So yes, it can go on, it can drag, it can have that aspect, but I think for the most part with ourselves and our group, we've managed to have it mostly be a 90-minute long experience.
So I want to go on now and talk about your media work. So firstly, why go into the murky world of YouTube?
I went into YouTube initially because I was trying to market Board Game Co., the retail operation. But a few months before YouTube, I had started dabbling in Instagram. I was trying to be on the socials because, you know, having a good social presence and all that stuff. And so I started YouTube knowing that it was basically a waste of time. But hey, I would do it. Instagram was fine, but the taking a picture and commenting on it just wasn't as much my genre, versus I've always enjoyed talking to a degree. So I started YouTube and threw a camera up and started having these videos here and there and getting nothing on them, because that's what typically happens when you start a YouTube channel, getting, you know, 30 views here, 42 views here, whatever it is, slowly adding up just enough that there's another reason to post that next video. But hey, on my time, at my leisure, when I want, however I want, no rush whatsoever. And then I started infrequently, just because I wanted something to talk about, I started dabbling and talking about, oh, and I should say, even before that happens, as I was doing this, I was already starting to find that I was enjoying myself. And what started off as very much a, hey, you know, this video is brought to you by Board Game Co., buy, sell, trade your way to better collection. Those are in my, like, first, you know, 10, maybe 15 videos, those little taglines where I try to promote the shop. And they very quickly disappeared as I realized that I just enjoy talking about board games. The same thing that had called me to it in the first place, knowing that it was a bad use of my time, was the same reason that I wanted to keep doing it. And it wasn't for that extra sale that got sent my way. It was because I liked talking about board games. And then at a certain point, I started talking about Kickstarters and why I back Kickstarters and talking about the value aspect of things in a way that to me was just me talking about my chain of thought. But somehow managed to hook people in a way that I don't think there was other content at the time focusing on that. There were other people talking about board games in many ways. There were other people covering Kickstarters in many ways. But no one was really talking about, hey, you know, I'm going to back this Kickstarter because, you know what, if it's not for me, who cares? I can sell it and not worry about it. Or I'm not going to back this Kickstarter because I'm just going to get this game later, but I'll get it when it's cheaper and not worry about it. And that's when my content managed to find an audience. I got lucky, so to speak. I managed to talk about something that I was passionate about and find a niche that was not being fully explored in the board game space. And from there, it's just one thing after another, all centering around this core concept of, I just like talking about board games.
And so you kind of touched on it, but so firstly, how has the channel changed over the years since you've had it? And secondly, how do you think you've improved as a performer?
So let's do one of those at a time. So how has it changed the last couple of years? It started off with me talking about topical things mostly. My first few videos were very focused on topical conversations, and I really enjoyed those, but it very much shifted towards Kickstarter content just because that's where the audience clearly was. And then for a short time frame, you know, whatever it was, maybe 6 months, a year, I don't know exactly, I very much was a Kickstarter channel first and foremost in everything I did. I also wanted to make sure that didn't stay the case, though. And so I tried embracing, at a certain point, I started diving more heavily into review content, which is something that I very infrequently did in my early days. I very, very, very infrequently did review content. It wasn't what I wanted to do. It's not what I enjoyed about the board game space. And I dived into that later, partially to round out the content, to ensure that I wasn't just a Kickstarter channel. I wanted to be covering the hobby from multiple angles, from top tens, from topics, from conversations. I wanted to be a kind of jack of all trades, hopefully not as much the master of none, but I wanted to talk about board games. I don't want to be locked down to a specific area. As time has gone on, I've pulled back a bit from prototype coverage. Not extensively, not a ton. I still cover prototypes, but I found that the constant attention of a prototype, which at first has a degree of compelling, a degree of, oh my gosh, I've been selected to cover this game, which is flattering and is rewarding and has these games that I managed to try that I am very grateful for. But at a certain point, the pile of prototype rulebooks keeps piling up and your schedule does not get easier. And a 60-page rulebook is a lot, and a 60-page prototype rulebook is a lot more. And it gets to be a lot on your schedule and on your mind, and it just starts really building up. And so I've slowly started over the past 6 months to 9 months, so I've slowly started pulling back a drop from just how much prototype content I do, trying to be more selective about that aspect. Still covering Kickstarter, still reviewing games, still having topical conversations. But I think for the past maybe year and a half, 2 years now, I've been mostly similar in the approach I take in terms of just trying to be as well-rounded as possible and cover as many different things. Yes, have Kickstarter content, but also have everything else, just so I can continue talking about board games in different ways.
How do you think you've improved as a performer?
Thank you. So I remember a particular point, and I think I want to say the video in question was a video about Storm Center, I want to say. But I remember my first days in the channel, my first content I put out, very much had pauses and ums and ahs, and also a degree of monotony to the voice utilized. A degree of monotony that is completely natural for when you're talking to your friends, but doesn't translate quite as well when you're on camera. It's just, it kind of just takes out, I guess the way I'd put it is, they say when you're on camera, you want to be like 10% more energy, not because you're trying to lie, but because you lose that otherwise when you're presenting. You lose that when you're trying to almost carry off a one-sided conversation where you don't have the natural back and forth that one might have in person between friends, where I could just say, oh, hey, by the way, I played Frozen Frontier. And then my friend could be like, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, well, how was that game? These back and forth in a conversation tend to be a little bit more monotone in their translation. And I remember that particular video, I believe it was a video about Storm Thunder, where I suddenly just realized, hey, you know what, I'm going to be a little bit more energetic. I'm going to inject that degree of extra performativeness to what I'm doing. And it really felt natural. It's, even though it's inherently not natural, it felt natural to add that, those tonal shifts, to pipe a little energy into your words, to be more mindful of the reflection that goes on each syllable or tangent or whatever it is you're doing there. All the while as well, by trying to be mindful of the ums and ahs that go into a conversation as well. There was a point where I had a rubber band around my wrist, and whenever I said in a conversation, I would snap it. And I still say ums here and there, but I certainly have improved in some way, however you want to, improved or decreased, however you want to put it, the amount of ums and ahs and pauses that go into a conversation, because those are things that, while they are natural, while they are normal, they don't translate as nicely into, well, content. And so things like that I've certainly been more mindful of. Doing my homework on things is another aspect. I remember a few early Kickstarters where I said things that were incorrect when judging a game in one sense or another. And then when I had someone point those things out to me, there was a degree of just sheer responsibility on me. A responsibility of, hey, I said this wasn't as good of a back and I was wrong. But I've said that now to, you know, hundreds of people, and who knows if they're going to see the correction I post next week. And that's a degree of obligation that I've very much do not like and still don't like, but it comes with the territory. And so the only counter to that is trying to be as accurate as possible. Just today, I played a game that, while I enjoy aspects of the game, I'm pretty sure the game is straight up broken. And I'll be going through the rulebook again with a fine-tooth comb a third time by now, because if I'm going to go on camera and say, hey, I like this game, but it's broken, I need to be darn sure that I'm right when I tell you exactly why I think there's a problem here and that I'm doing the rules right. And so extra degrees of research or diligence in what I'm doing, those are things I've definitely tried adding as time has gone on, as the channel has gotten larger, and the larger it gets, the more mindful I am of the impact of the words that I say. Impact that might be required at times, but I want it to be at the very least to be accurate.
And is there anything you've done on the channel that you're particularly proud of?
Proud of is an interesting question. There are definitely videos I have that I view as my favorites, but I don't know if they're necessarily videos that I'm proud of. They're just videos that resonate with me. As far as proud of, I would say that I've always been very focused, possibly unintentionally at first, but then as it happened with more intent, I've always been very focused on trying to spread the love, of trying to shine a light on other channels as much as possible. Whenever I find a content creator that I enjoy, whenever I find anything within the space that I enjoy, I try to showcase it as much as possible, whether in dedicated videos, whether in infrequent shoutouts. And I think the first time I did it was kind of just, the first time I did it was a video of top 10 YouTubers, top 10 board game YouTubers that I enjoy. And as a result of doing that video, where I think for me, that was just another opportunity to talk about things that I liked. It wasn't meant to be sharing. It wasn't meant to be nice. It wasn't meant to be kind. I'd love to take credit and say it was, but it wasn't. It was just me talking about people I liked, no differently than the way I talked about board games I liked. But in that video, I remember I got hundreds and hundreds of comments from both people, content creators who are grateful for me shouting out to their channels, but also for people who are saying, and this one, and that one, and what about this one? And I realized there's such a huge opportunity to constantly shine a light on others as much as possible. Ideally, because it's content that resonates with you. Ideally, a natural shout out that really, really is from the heart, because you can say, this is why I like this person, and this is why I enjoy them. And there's so many people out there that fall into that category that's so easy to constantly raise others up. It's so easy to push people in a direction and say, hey, by the way, I think this person does the best playthroughs I've ever seen. I think this person does the best interviews I've ever seen. I think that person, that couple has such a degree of charisma that it's so fun to watch them as they go through it. It's so easy to share and push people. And I think that in terms of the words proud, I think that's the only area that I could really point at that I think I'm proud of.
And you know, you've been talking about it. I mean, how important is community around your channel, and how much do you think community has led to its success?
I think community in any channel is essential, but not necessarily for the reasons we're saying. I think it depends on what we define as community, but as a baseline, I think people like having somewhere to talk and to reflect off others. And to some extent, that might mean commenting on video and getting a reply back from the person posting the video, which is something that early days, for a long, long time, I replied to every single comment for a long time. And that's because, hey, you've watched my video, you left a comment, you gave me the time of day, I'll give it right back to you because I appreciate it. But then even past that, community extends well past the creator. Community extends to the fact that when someone posts a comment on my video, even if I don't have time to respond or engage, someone else might. And so again, it encourages the idea, it encourages the interaction, it encourages the algorithm because of the fact that people see that what they're doing is not just going into the void of the internet, it's in some way being reflected, it's getting 3 likes from that person, it's getting a comment from that person, maybe a heart from me. And so there is a degree of interaction that inspires further interaction and does help with the success, if only because of the fact that it helps with the algorithm. But then there's an additional fact that someone can share a video to whoever they want. We have a thriving Discord member with thousands of members that I share with Quackalope. It's a shared Discord that has thousands and thousands of active members that has grown well past myself and Jesse's involvement in the channel because there's just a lot of people around. People to talk about the latest video I put out. People to talk about the fact that, you know, they just dropped a Jurassic World review on the Dice Tower with like abundance of threes. And now it's a conversation, even because I liked it. I liked the game. I didn't love the game, but I liked the game. And so that was a conversation of, oh, Alex, you know, you liked the game. What's going on with this Dice Tower thing? And it's an engagement and it's a back and forth and it's a conversation. And I think community generally helps. I don't know if or when it's essential, but it gives people a reason to want to stick around. It gives people a reason to want to comment. It gives people a reason to want to become a Patreon, to join the Discord, any of these things. I don't think it ever doesn't help. How much it helps is a harder to define thing.
So your next game then is Too Many Bones. Does this successfully meld RPGs and board games?
I think it does. I think it does. I think if I'm trying to think through games that give me that real leveling up, skill building experience and a board game, I think Too Many Bones is certainly going to be at the top of the list, with others as well, of course. But I think Too Many Bones does a fantastic job of giving me a reason to continuously dive into it, if only so that I can build my character a different way, so that I can see how they're going to adjust in terms of the way if I take this arc or that arc against that boss with those encounters. It's a game that I have a ton of content for the game, and I've only played 4 or 5 characters just because of the sheer depth of experience that each character gives you. And it does give it in a very episodic nature. So it does, I mean, it depends on how you define something as a board game versus an RPG. It's very episodic, it's very scenario-based, but it definitely feels like a board game, and it definitely gives me that RPG feeling at the same time. And so, yeah, I think so.
And so, my current sort of preoccupation is railing against what I deem decadent production in board games. I've written an article for a magazine for it. I released a podcast talking about it recently. And this game seems that it's been endlessly expanded and the production of it is sort of fairly crazy. Is it too much, do you think?
Too much is an interesting question. Too much is a very interesting question. I think the question is, there's two kinds of content as a baseline. There's the amount of content and there's the type of production. Those are both very different things. As far as the amount of content, there's definitely a lot. Too much kind of depends on whether you're engaging with it as a lifestyle experience or whether you're engaging with it as a one-off. And that's a very big problem we have in the board game world in general, where there's far too many games that give you so much content that if someone is treating it as the game that they dive into, then it's nothing compared to Magic the Gathering, compared to Warhammer, compared to a million other games, miniature games or productions or LCGs or trading card games. Inherently, the biggest board games still suffer in comparison to those. But if you're comparing it to having a shelf full of 50 of them, well, that's a different conversation. And so too much is tricky because there's going to be different audiences who engage with it. There's going to be people who actually go through all the content. There's going to be those that only buy the base game. And there's going to be the problematic category, although problematic is not with any judgment, especially since I'm included in it, which is the category of people who buy it but don't engage with it. So you're both consuming but not even utilizing, which if you want to be a collector, that's fine. It's just that's where we get into potential area of why is something being created and who's it for. As far as the production aspect is premium. But again, too much is a question and a conversation. Is a Rolex too much? I don't even know cars at all. It's an Audi too much. Audis aren't even that fancy.
This is an area that I know zero about. So you're going to have to rely on yourself, I'm afraid.
Lamborghini seemed like an expensive car. Isn't a Lamborghini too much? There are so many different categories of where something is too much or not. Is it a premium product? Absolutely. Does that have the unfortunate side effect of the fact that people who want the product for its functionality but are thrown off and locked out because of its premium aspect? Absolutely, it does. But at what point do we otherwise draw the line? Where do we say you're allowed to have a premium product or not for a premium audience? I think for the most part in the board game space, there's going to be a million games out there that you can buy for $40 a pop and have a ton of fun. Games that I will recommend from today until tomorrow because of how enjoyable they are, because of how accessible they are, because of how cheap they are. I will recommend them left, right, and center. And then there's going to be big box productions or over-the-top plastic games you can dump into your bathtub. So is it too much? It's a lot. It's a premium product. I don't know if I'd be willing to say it's too much.
And so you've kind of touched on it. Are you attracted to lifestyle games, and is this one?
I am reluctantly attracted to lifestyle games. The idea of a lifestyle game, almost inherently in its nature, is that it's a lifestyle game. And so it's very hard to be attracted to multiple of them because we only have the one life, and there's only so many lifestyle games we can really engage in. I would say that I am constantly compelled by games that offer you that degree of world building experience, immersion, and tons of content behind it for when I inevitably fall in love. The problem is I'm still searching. I'm still looking for the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And that means inevitably I'm always picking up more lifestyle games than those that I actually have time to dive into. And that results in some games that I fall in love with and really enjoy and can't wait for the next amount of content for that game. Other games that I never actually successfully table or only table a few times before realizing that I won't actually give it the degree of commitment that it deserves. So I would say I am attracted to lifestyle games. This absolutely is one, and it'd be great if I could dial back my attraction just a tad.
So I want to move on now and talk about something we've already touched on a bit, and that's your faith. So we've mentioned that you subscribe to Orthodox Judaism. Could you unpack that for me and the listeners who have heard the term but don't really know what it is?
Sure. So this is a rabbit hole of a conversation we can go any number of ways with, but I'm an Orthodox Jew. As far as what that means, Judaism is a religion out there, and Orthodox Jew generally is referring to a category of Judaism that it does fall to be a bit more observant in what they subscribe to, what they do, and whatnot. They're going to be different categories of Judaism, all that define themselves differently. But for the most part, Orthodox Judaism believes in the commandments as originally written, with degrees of interpretation around them, but not a shifting narrative of what it is. And so overall, that's a religion I grew up with, and it's a religion that I am inherently biased towards because I grew up with it, but also one that I've done a degree of soul searching around at the same time. I like to read no differently than I like TED Talks about any number of different conversations or books about, I don't know, how to be a better person. I've also read and engaged in any number of different books of religious texts, books that give me, I guess there's two different conversations at play when you're religious. The first is, why do you believe in any construct at all? And the second is, why do you believe in your particular construct? And those are two very different conversations with very different rabbit holes to go down. I would say, as far as why I believe, there's a particular book that I highly recommend for those who are interested in the conversation called Permission to Believe, which is not about Judaism specifically. It is written by a Jew, but it's not about Judaism specifically. It's just about the nature of, very often, the idea of believing has so many questions around it that sometimes those who do believe get lumped into a category of, well, why do you believe in this thing with no proof, with no evidence? And the idea of permission to believe is it goes through logical reasons as to why, not that there is guaranteed of any way, shape, or form to be a deity out there, but why at the very least it makes sense. That it's more than just a construct created by a bunch of tribal elders, but there's lots of evidence, both scientifically based and otherwise, to show that it is a perfectly rational option on the table. Option being the key word. Just option, nothing more than that. Past that, there's a question of Judaism itself, why I believe in Judaism. That one is a significantly more complicated conversation to go down. I do have reasons, absolutely, but those are reasons that I would say I prefer to go into when I'm engaging with somebody directly, because the problem with saying those things on a on a conversation like this is inherently I'm giving my reason without giving others an opportunity to respond or engage, which could put people on the defensive. I would say I have my reasons as much as anyone else has theirs, and I'm always happy to have that conversation in person where we can engage and interact in a one-to-one nature or whatnot. But yeah, that's the background to my faith and all that.
I mean, so you grew up in a Jewish area of town, you went to a Jewish school, you've been observant your entire life. I mean, when you think of your family and your community, would apostasy be an option? Is it, I mean, would you be disowned if you rejected the faith?
That usually depends on the family. It's a big deal, and make no mistake. It's not something taken lightly as, oh, hey, you decide to move to this neighborhood, that neighborhood. It's absolutely a rejection of what I grew up with, and is absolutely a big deal. There are many people who will have situations in which a family member walks away from the faith and they don't talk to them. Most of the time, that's not the encouraged behavior or the desired behavior. You're always supposed to have a relationship with people in your family, regardless of what they do. It can be hard. It can be hard to look at something that is so intrinsic to who you are and see your children or family members or whoever reject that and not have it become an issue. But I would say, in my case, just guessing, if that were something that happened to me, I imagine I would still have a relationship with my family. The community, probably less so, but the community has less ties to me. The community's ties to me are the faith. And so, you know, individual friends I'd probably keep and family I'd probably keep, but it's definitely... The religion is definitely not the religion, the inherent nature of the community is definitely structured in such a way that walking away from it is certainly going to have a very significant impact on your relationships in very many ways.
And so I've spoken to my Jewish friends, one Jewish friend in particular, I constantly badger about religion whenever we're together. I'm sure he's completely fed up with my questions. But I appreciate that Judaism is a faith that is being constantly revised and there's constant sort of scholarly adaptations of it. But this is a religion that fundamentally is fermented many thousands of years ago. And when I think of Shabbat and not being able to drive cars and so on and so forth, I mean, how difficult is it to follow your faith in the context of the modern world?
It definitely has its challenges, but I think those challenges are very different depending on, well, any number of different things. So for instance, in my case, it's a fairly minimal challenge, although it's a challenge that has become more prevalent as I've entered this board game space in a very public way, as I try to go to conventions over Shabbat and try to juggle, you know, the rules and obligations I'm trying to follow while engaging with the convention in some way, shape, or form. But those things tend to be very situational as far as when there are conflicts. The world in which we are in today is far more understanding of different cultures and different ways and different conflicts in a way that usually doesn't result in the same problems they used to. It used to be that when you came here from the old world, Jews who moved here from Europe who tried to work here, there was a general expression amongst Jews, I can't remember the exact expression, but the idea was, you know, that you started looking for a job every Monday. Because you start working, and then you'd get to Shabbat, and then they'd say, hey, you're coming in Saturday? They're like, well, we can't come in Saturday. And they're like, well, you're fired then. We can't have you if you can't come in Saturday. And that was a concept that certainly was true once upon a time in America and other places. Versus nowadays, very often it is very hard to find a place that doesn't adjust around cultural holidays, whatever that culture might be, whether it's Judaism, whether it's whatever culture you're from that celebrates any number of different days or opportunities. It's a much more culturally welcoming society that we live in, and a much more understanding one. And Saturday happens to not be a standard workday anymore as well, which has a nice little convenient aspect to it. And so there are degrees of conflicts where the rules we're trying to follow, the rules an Orthodox Jew is trying to follow, has an impact. Very often, a very common one is just going to be the idea that if you have a work lunch, or, you know, if I'm going to a convention and hanging out with friends, you know, you might be going to a bar down the road and I'll get drinks, but I won't have anything else because it's very specific rules about what I can and can't eat. And so I'll try to be socially mindful and present, but there'll be inherent conflicts around that. I would say that for the most part, for those dedicated enough to following the things they want to follow, it is always possible to do so. Are there sacrifices and trade-offs along the way? 100% there are.
Now, I assume that your adhesion to your faith is not just theological, but also moral. Do you think that you, having not been born into an Orthodox Jewish family, do you think that you would have arrived at the moral conclusions that you have within Judaism if you hadn't been born to it?
Yes and no. I think for the most part, yes, but certainly in certain circumstances, no. A basic question I've just having this with a friend yesterday around the idea of if you don't have a faith-based morality, then what is your source of morality? Meaning, if you don't have a set of rules from some sense of something, then what defines morality for you? And there's many philosophers around this, around the nature of morality, different, you know, Kant or whatever, different types of principles that backtrack to how a moral, endpoint is concluded. But it's just, it inherently, they all become complicated. Religion, to a certain extent, makes it a little simpler, but it also does so in ways and times that will conflict with my own sense of morality. Something I talk about frequently with friends is, if I always agree with what my religion tells me to do, then what did I need the religion for? If I'm always going to inherently arrive at the exact same conclusion, then the religion isn't the guiding faith, my own morality is the guiding faith. And certainly, if my own morality overrides that of religion, then again, it's not religion that's guiding me, it's me that's guiding religion. And so there are times and instances where what religion might define as being the moral outcome is something that I would personally disagree with. And I'm comfortable with that. This conversation inherently can result in the kind of thing that results in a crisis of faith, in some sort of horrible thing that seems moral, seems immoral to you, but is moral according to religion. You can absolutely have a crisis of faith along these lines. I would say I've been fortunate enough to never really have that. I've had small edge cases where something might be determined as being the right course, and I'm like, huh, that's not the way I would do it, but, you know, that's fine. Religion's here to guide me. I'm not here to guide religion. So I think, you know, if you're talking with the big ones, don't kill, don't murder, you shalt not that, you shalt not this, if you want to pull all those kinds of conversations out, I think most of those, most people within most societies do come to those determinations on their own. Are there differences? Absolutely there's differences. But that's where you get into that weird gap where who's guiding who? Is the religion guiding you or are you guiding the religion?
And a source of so much tension in the world is the clash of Abrahamic religions. You know, your three main big ones, your Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And these three main religions make mutually exclusive claims, not only about the nature of reality, but the nature of morality and the nature of the afterlife. Can these three religions ever reconcile, or are they doomed to fight as long as they survive?
I think there's a difference between reconciliation versus fighting. I think that there's two different kinds of conversations here. There's the nature of agreement and disagreement, and it's the nature of how those agreements and disagreements manifest. So those, as you said already, all three religions are inherently contradictory in terms of where they end up, in terms of what they're saying is true. But to me, I don't need to be quote-unquote right. If I'm having a conversation and I'm friends with people of many faiths, including all the Abrahamic religions, and I would say that most of the time a friendship amongst these religions is very, very doable when you don't have a need to be right about something that doesn't have to be a conversation. If I have my own personal belief system and you have your own personal belief system, there's effectively three ways we can handle it. We can, you know, engage in it good-natured while having conversations because we like to learn more about each other. We can choose to not talk about it at all, or we could engage with it and have a problem. Only one of those three outcomes is actually a problem. Choosing to not engage is totally viable. Hey, by the way, we have this difference of opinion, and this difference of opinion, by the way, applies to further than just religion. It can apply to politics as well. If you have a friend that you're friends with and you know that both of you have this very strongly differing viewpoint on a particular subject, and you're not likely to come to terms in it. If you're likely to come to terms in it, hey, you know, conversations could be great. But if you know you're likely to disagree, you know, they're voting for them, they believe this, you believe that, whatever conversation it is, sometimes you can just say, you know what, I value the relationship enough that we don't need to be on the same page about everything. And so we can either talk about it or not talk about it, but we don't need to be on the same page. And so the nature of conflict is a very different conversation than the nature of agreement. I think that, unfortunately, amongst large enough sets of people, again, no different than politics, a large enough sets of people with very strongly differing viewpoints, I think it is unlikely you will ever have everyone taking the stance that we can just all get along. I think there will be conflict. I would like it to be as minimal as possible. I'd like to be as isolated as possible. I'd like those who are seeking conflict to be not the determining factors, but rather the edge cases where everyone looks at them and rolls their eyes thinking, we just don't need this. But it likely will happen to some extent. I just hope it's minimal.
So your next game then is Vindication. How well does this game evoke its theme?
Horribly. Horribly so. Oh my gosh, Vindication is horribly... I mean, they have a full expansion, Vindication Chronicles, specifically designed to address this problem. Vindication is an idea that you are wretched. You are washed up ashore, wretched and alone, and you have to in some way, you know, I can't... make yourself recovered or whatever. There's some pathway there as far as what you're doing. But the theme is completely abstracted to the nth degree of anything. Like, it's a game that I adore. I adore the game. I love it. But it's completely unrelated to any semblance of theme whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. I would double down and triple down on just how far removed it is from a theme, but it's just so removed. But yeah, we'll see what the expansion does. They have an expansion that adds a lot of story interactions. I still feel it will be a bit pasted on, but I'm sure I'll enjoy it.
So I'm going to release a show to my patrons soonish in which I make the claim that theme is utterly inconsequential to board games. It is completely unnecessary, and people harping on about a lack of theme really don't understand the concept of an art form that is so mechanically forward as board games. Am I an idiot?
No. I mean, you're going to have people disagree with you, but I think that theme is something that, like an art style, is there to appeal to those who appreciate it. Is it necessary to the board game? Depends. It depends on why you play a game. There are people who might not play a game because of such an art. Look at me and Inish. I almost didn't pick up Inish because the art didn't appeal to me. I would say that I side more strongly with your opinion than not, but I think there'll be those of all kinds who have different reasons they play board games.
And why are you taking this one to the cabin?
Oh, because of how variable it is. Vindication is a game that gives me that cube-pushing puzzle of trying to figure out how to be as efficient as possible in a way that there's handfuls and handfuls and decks and decks and decks full of cards that you only ever engage with a handful of them every single game. And the combination of the cards each time represents a different puzzle. And the way the tiles and the map develops, it presents a completely different puzzle. And Vindication is a game that even just the base game comes with it, a bunch of modules baked into it, a bunch of modules to expand and iterate upon your game. And I haven't felt the need to dive into most of those modules yet, because every time I play Vindication, it's already different. So a game that has lots of expansion content baked into the base game that I still haven't felt the need to engage with, that to me is a game that is constantly giving me a highly variable experience that I incredibly appreciate. And if I can only have five games, this one better be one of them.
So I want to talk now about the future. So you recently got a new job. Can you tell us what it is?
I recently became hired as CMO of GameFound, as the chief marketing officer. It's a very exciting opportunity, very intrigued as far as how this is going to change my life, but we'll see what happens.
And so, as part of this, you said to me in the notes that you're preparing to close down Board Game Co. And as we've already established, you are, you know, flinty-hearted and have zero sentimentality. Are you going to be sad to close Board Game Co. down?
Yeah, I am. Zero sentimentality is probably the wrong term. Very, very, very little is probably more accurate. Board Game Co. is something that I spent 10 years of my life on, from late 2011, so I guess closing on 11 years on. And it's something that has been a big part of my life for a very, very, very long time. And I would have loved to see it continue. And it's possible it still does, although as days go by, I think it's less and less likely. But there are options being explored as far as liquidating the collection versus selling off the business entirely. Different options that are on the table, and I would have loved to see it continue. I just think it's a good thing in the board game space. And yes, selfishly, I put a lot of time and effort into growing it. I will be fine. I am not going to lose sleep over it, and I will be fine. But there is a small part of me that, from a sentimental stance, would love to see it continue.
And so what is the future for the YouTube channel as well? Will you continue to do that, or will the new job take up all of your time?
The YouTube channel is definitely continuing. When I took the job, I made a commitment to them and to myself that I'm not interested in taking on a job unless I'm willing to give it 100%. And so I wanted to view two things as true. I both don't want to give up the YouTube channel because I'm very, very attached to it, and I really enjoy talking about board games, and I like what I'm doing in the space. But also, I have to be committed to the new job. And so the net result of it is both are continuing, both are happening. There may be trade-offs that have to be made at some points in different ways along the way, but it's going to, my goal is to keep those to be as minimal as possible, both in terms of the way the content changes, which I want to keep as minimal as possible, if at all, as well as the fact that there's the possibility that maybe I put up a few videos less a week, although I already said on a channel that I was going to, and so far I'm refusing to not, because, again, I just like talking about board games. And so we'll see. I imagine that the changes are minimal. I imagine the schedule changes are minimal. I imagine the content changes are minimal. I just like it too much to stop engaging with it the way that I have. And so we'll see what happens, but we'll see.
And so what do you think your niche is in the grander universe of board games?
That is a hard one to know for sure. With this move into GameFound, my niche may simply be having a hopefully lasting and positive effect on crowdfunding. Even though I specifically have made goals around the channel to not just be the Kickstarter guy, it may be that that's what I end up being with this move to GameFound, which I don't necessarily mind as long as that Kickstarter guy is because I've had a positive effect on the crowdfunding space. For me, it's never been a larger picture thing. I don't have grandiose visions for myself of who I am and how important I can be in this sense. I just like talking about board games. That's primarily been the motivator the entire time. Anything else peripheral to that, anything else around how I do things, why I do things, is always based on the fact that I wanted to be able to talk about board games while being able to make money talking about board games so that I can do so more instead of having to worry about other expenses or jobs or opportunities or things. In the case of GameFound, it became an opportunity that is related enough to what I'm doing and close enough to the thing that I love that I am compelled by it as well. But I'm just the guy who likes talking about board games. And if I can do so in a way that helps others, great. And if my content isn't for you, that's totally fine too. There's so many people out there. There's so many opportunities in different ways as far as what you can get out of a content creator and why you're there. I'd like to have a positive impact on the space, but that's secondary to the fact that I just like board games.
So your final game then is Cascadia. How happy were you that this won the Spiel des Jahres?
Oh, not, oh, no, no. I was about to be cold and dead inside, and I realized I actually wasn't. My instinctive answer was going to be, I don't care. I mean, I like the game. Why do I need to win the Spiel des Jahres? But the truth is, I am happy, and I was happy. Because I think any game that wins the Spiel des Jahres, or any award for that matter, is a degree of, hey, everyone, here's this game that you can enjoy. But selfishly, for me, I think that when it's a game that I recognize or like as well, there is a degree of being able to see that thing you like shared with others. No differently than when I do a review, I'm trying to share something I like with others. When having a game you love get the Spiel des Jahres is almost having someone else do the work for you. Awesome. I love Cascadia. I think it's highly accessible. I think it's highly engaging. I think it's a great gateway game that can really grow with you and do a very good job. And you know what? Now a whole lot more people know about it. Now a whole lot more people get that stamp of this is a great game. And even though it's true that that can be true, even if it's a game I didn't like or didn't care for, never even heard of, there is that selfish aspect of thank you for sharing the thing I love with so many others and for helping that happen. So yeah, I was happy.
And so I have yet to play this, but friends of mine who have played it turned their nose up a bit when it won the award. Why do you think this specific game deserved to win it?
Interesting. So I can say I've been in the position of having certainly turned my nose up at other games. In the case of Cascadia, I adore it. I remember when I first found out it was the number one rated abstract or something, or maybe family game. It was some number one. I think it was abstract on Board Game Geek, and I had the same degree of excitement around that. I think Cascadia deserves the award because it does a few things really, really well. The first is the theme. We've seen more and more how nature themes to a large degree can pull in audiences that are very casual and can become great ambassadors for the hobby, not just working within the hobby itself, but working to bring people towards the hobby. The second is the fact that the game I find is incredibly easy to teach. The mechanics and scoring are as simple as grabbing a tile, matching things up, and then having a scoring goal to go for. It's a game that I can get you up and running in 4 or 5 minutes tops and teaching you almost everything you need to know. And thirdly, it's highly variable in what it does as it goes through it. It's highly variable in the sense that every single combination of cards gives you a different scoring opportunity, and the combinations of those cards means there's constantly reason to dive into it, and it's rewarding to do so. It's rewarding to simply build out your own puzzles, and it's also doing doing so in a very low conflict way, which to some people can make it a turnoff. You might want more conflict, more challenge, more tenseness, whereas this is mostly multiplayer solitaire with the occasional time where you cringe because someone took your combination of tiles. But for the most part, you're doing your own thing. You're building out your own stuff. No one's really heavily getting in your way, which again has a trade-off in terms of being the right tool for some, but for others makes it a great ambassador to the hobby as you say, hey, you know those terrible experiences you've had of this, that, and the other? Here's this light, charming game that plays in 30 to 45 minutes, that's easy to teach, and manages to give you a highly strategic experience all at the same time. That crux of high strategy with low rules and high accessibility has constantly been a metric of what wins this build this Yaris, and I think that the Cascadia definitely hit those notes.
So I've got one last question for you then. So you're heading out of Cleveland, you whiz past the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you go around a corner and the back door of the car flies open. Four of the games fly out down a ravine into a river and are swept away to posterity. Which game do you hope is sitting on the backseat of the car?
So I think this question is so good, or I should rephrase that as the games I picked are so good that offhand I think only one of them is immediately eliminated. And it is the one we just talked about. I think Cascadia can go. It's fine. I love Cascadia. There's a reason I picked it. But as far as the other games on the table, I think Cascadia can walk away. From there, from the other four, it's very hard to have a wrong choice. But instinctively, and with great love in my heart, I really hope that I look back and see Too Many Bones on the backseat.
So if people want to get hold of you and all of that good stuff, how can they go about doing that?
You can find me in a few different places. You can find me over on YouTube at Board Game Co. Just search for Board Game Co. I'll pop up in way too many videos. Past that, I still occasionally dabble in Instagram content, not as religiously as I'd like, but you can find me over at BGC_BoardGameCo, if I recall correctly. And then also I've been engaging in Twitch content recently over on Twitch at twitch.com/camp_coop, COOP, where we're playing a bunch of cooperative campaign games and really giving those lifestyle games an opportunity to shine. But any of those places, or anywhere else, or even just, you know, email me or anything, I'm around and easy to find.
Brilliant. Well, Alex Radcliffe, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. This is an absolute blast.
You can support the show in many ways. You can tell your friends, you can talk about it on social media, you can talk about it in your own blog, podcast, or video, or you can support it directly by going to patreon.com/5G4D for a rolling donation, or for a one-off donation, hitting the PayPal link at the bottom of the website, 5gamesfordoomsday.com. It's these donations that keep the show going. Also, if you want to say something nice about the show, if you want to say something horrible about the show, you can contact me on Twitter at 5games4doomsday, or send me an email at 5gamesfordoomsday@gmail.com. And if I've managed to leg it from the vanishing Griblies and your bloody banter, I'll see you in 2 weeks for another 5 Games for Doomsday.